This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Monsters and Men, Gothic Classics and the Origin of Horror, a Halloween special with special guest S.C. Paris. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
Great to have you on the show.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've literally been waiting for ages. Sorry, I'll let you introduce in a second. I just want to say, I've been waiting for ages to get Sharon on the show. I have been because I mentioned it to you like months ago, and
yes,
so I was like, come on, gotta get her on, and then Jules is like, Halloween special, and I was like, oh, I know the person.
Well, sorry. I'm glad to be here finally.
Sorry, Jules, continue.
You know, it was probably redundant. I was just going to say that Sharon is actually the author of the rather popular and gaining a following Dark World series.
Popular.
Oh, don't know. It seems to be doing quite well.
Yeah.
Does it?
Yeah, it's got a bit of a following.
I see your followers there.
We don't stalk writers online or anything.
No, of course not.
Wait, I really have followers? I had no idea.
Of course you do.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's a fun series, I think, dealing with my favorite monsters, vampires, obviously, and werewolves and dragons and giants and mermaids and everything in there.
And elves.
And elves. Oh, I always forget the elves. Yes,
elves. So neglected.
They do. Well, they're not in my latest book I'm writing right now, book 5, The Goblet. I'm actually going to expand on them a bit more.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't able to in the first 4, because I had to rewrite books 1 and 3 and cut them down because my publisher said they were too long, which is ridiculous to me. But no, they said the first book was 130,000 words, and they said we have to cut it down to 100,000. And I'm like, you do know this is epic fantasy, right? Like, this is supposed to be huge. But they're like, no, they're going to be on the shelves, they have to be a certain size. And I'm just like, oh my god. Like, I'm losing all of the good parts. So that was fun. But I'm trying to keep the story going and keep it, I guess, cohesive.
Yeah.
With the word count being so cut so much.
Well, I feel a bit of a slouch now because you're on book 5 and I'm like thinking about starting book 3 next month.
Oh, well. I mean, no, I would probably be on book 3 if it wasn't for all my deadlines, because I had to rewrite books 1, 2, and 3 this year, on top of editing the previous books as well, and writing book 4. So, I mean,
well, screw you guys, I haven't even finished book 3 yet. So,
well, Madeleine, I mean, your books are so there's so much in them. Oh my gosh, I love it. I love your, oh my god, I can't.
No,
I'm serious. No. I have a copy of The Sons of Destiny with me right now, and it's so, no, I'm like, it's my favorite book, you have no idea. Like, I'm not even lying. It's so good. It's everything I've wanted from a fantasy novel. Like, I'm serious. Everything I've ever wanted from a fantasy book.
Fine, you stop just it. We're talking about your books today. So enough of that, madam.
Well, looking toward what I want to do for the series, your book is a pretty good example of where I wanted to go with mine. My second book, The Immortal's Guide, was supposed to be this big, epic, you know, journey across the landscape. And I had to cut a lot of that out, and I was so mad because I wanted it to be a big book that people took, you know, months to get through. Because that's, to me, that's the joy of reading. I love big books, so, you know, there was never me making the short book of them just, you know, finding the Immortal's Guide in, like, the first chapter. Like, no, there's gonna be trials and tribulations, and Xavier is a mess, so, you know, they're dealing with his madness, because he's succumbing to Eleanor, and, you know, and I wanted to play up that, but I had to figure out different ways to do that with the books further in the series.
It is interesting, because, you know, you're advertising it and you're writing it as this epic fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's this interesting way that you have merged the gothic and epic fantasy, because, you know, they play around each other a little bit for me, it feels like you've really taken it in an entirely new direction. And so, you know, it's epic fantasy, obviously, what you're writing. But would you also call it sort of fantasy gothic or anything like that?
Yeah. I call it dark fantasy, too.
Dark fantasy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know that was a thing for the longest.
and you've got Dracula in it.
Mm-hmm. I do, yes.
So talk to us a little bit about your, I'm going to call it an obsession. It's not an obsession, but
no,
talk about your interest in Dracula.
It is an obsession. No, I was always scaring myself as a kid, you know, reading Goosebumps and reading horror novels and everything. So, and then I remember watching Bram Stoker's Dracula, like, years ago with my mom, and being so mesmerized and creeped out by, you know, this vampire, and I was just like, what is that? That's so amazing, and he's, like, crawling on walls, and I'm like, this is so scary, this is awesome, you know, drinking blood and everything, and that was so cool to me. So, when I started writing my series, after I finished reading the last Harry Potter, I took 30 minutes to let it sink in, it's over, oh my god, my childhood, you know? And then I just sat down at the computer and started writing, and when it got to, you know, writing Dracula in that scene in his office, that was the first time I was like, oh, okay. I didn't even know if I was going to have Dracula in my series. I was like, can I do that? I was like, I don't know if I can. And once I found out I could, I was like, okay, because there has to be, you know, someone, you know, in charge of the vampires, and who better to be in charge than Dracula? And when it came time to picking, you know, his features and, you know, his story, kind of, It was like, okay, so what is he gonna look like? And I don't know why, in my 16-year-old mind at the time, I figured a lot of Draculas had like black hair and, you know, were like younger looking and attractive. And I wanted to make mine older and, you know, with the white hair and just weathered and, like, I don't know, older. I mean, when I was 16, all I was doing was just writing the book I wanted to read. And yeah. And it was just fun. It was just like, oh, I have these characters and they have this distinctive, you know, feature about them. And I was writing it for my friends, honestly. So I asked my friends, like, what they wanted to see, and they told me, and that's what I put down. And I changed it a bit now, obviously, but Dracula was always, like, my creation. And I was just like, yeah, he's going to have brown eyes and, you know, he's just going to be, like, a little bit older. And a troubled, troubled, troubled soul. very troubled.
I really enjoyed about the Dark World, actually, was the fact that obviously Dracula's been reimagined and reused so many times, and yes, the film you mentioned is like one of my favourite films ever. I'd say it's definitely my favourite vampire film, and it's probably my favourite adaptation of the full Dracula story. But you, obviously Dracula's been portrayed as something quite monstrous, something quite bestial that you can't touch, as something quite debonair that's a bit seductive, and somehow you've managed to get little bits of all of that in and still make him very much your own thing as well, which is really impressive because obviously it has been done.
Yes.
That's really, really good.
Thank you so much.
I know you wanted to go for someone a bit older and weathered and clearly someone who's experienced, and I don't want to give the ending away, but it was quite a surprise ending. I was like, what have you done?
Oh, yes, the ending.
Yeah.
No spoilers, guys, come on.
I'll try not to spoil it, but,
You can't spoil your own book, Lord.
No. I wrote, that was the only thing in the book that has never changed throughout all of the rewrites and, you know, everything, a little bits and pieces changed throughout the book as I rewrote it. But that ending, I wrote the last, like, four chapters in one night in, like, 5 hours, just nonstop writing, like, oh my god, the story's coming together, and I just couldn't stop writing it. Yeah, and that's when you see, you know, what Jack was really doing and kind of how mad he is. And I was like, I didn't know if I wanted to make him the bad guy or the good guy, or, you know, I didn't know what his story was as I was writing it until I got to the end, and I'm like, okay, now I know what he's doing and who he is and why he's doing it. But as the series goes on, the other vampires learn more about him that they didn't know. And it gets more and more complicated as it goes on. And I don't want to spoil it, but,
It was that strategic mind that I liked about him, because he was clearly doing some.
You
planning.
And your strategic minds.
I can't help it.
Jules loves always her favorite characters are always the ones who are kind of a little bit crafty and strategic and sort of working
morally
in the
dubious.
Shadow. Morally dubious.
So Eleanor then too,
yes,
I imagine.
I really, really liked Eleanor. That was my next point.
Everyone loves Eleanor. Even someone who just read it, a reviewer, said she loved Eleanor as well. And I'm like, why does everyone love her? Like, she is so twisted. Like, I love her too, but she's me in, like, all of my previous relationships. I'm not even joking. No, I'm not even joking. She's me. Like, you know, I am a very, like, hopeless romantic. So, when I was younger, it was very like do or die, you know, I need this person in my life or else I'm incomplete type of thing. So I just use that for her. Like, she's me. I mean, each person in the book is me in a sense, but you know, she's me. And
yeah, she's very driven and again scheming, so totally my type of character.
Extremely. No, she's very powerful and very seductive and very, she knows how to get what she wants, and I love that about her. And I'm really surprised there's not more female antagonists in books. I thought there would be.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean there.
Everyone's always surprised. They're like, oh, she's the antagonist. And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, wow. And I'm like, why are you surprised? Like, there should be more females, you know, trying to, you know, take over the world or...
I was going to make a Hillary Clinton joke just then.
Oh,
but,
wow.
we're not going down that rabbit hole.
Okay, I'm not going to go down that rabbit then.
Not this week.
No. Well, I mean, so. Yeah. I mean, the other females in the series, in the book, in the first book, Jules, what did you think about Lilith? I want your opinion.
I'm not sure I entirely sort of got her.
Okay.
As in, I'm not entirely sure I got her motivations, but I felt like they were being held back for a reason and that it was coming later on in the series, so.
Okay, yeah, that's definitely what's happening. But do you mind her being like, you know, 16 years, she's young, she's like 16 years old.
No, that doesn't bother me. But then, I mean, I've read an awful lot of vampire type fiction from everything from Polidori to Anne Rice, basically. Mm. So
I've never read Anne Rice. Don't kill me.
Okay.
No, people figure that out and they're like, how? And I'm like, I refuse to until I finish my series.
That's probably a good thing, actually.
But don't worry, you're not going to get in trouble for not reading a book in front of Jules. If that was the case, I would have been. She would have kicked my ass a very long time ago.
I do other things than read, I promise.
Sure you do.
It's funny because people think I write like her, and I don't. I mean, it's a compliment, obviously, but I just don't. I don't know. I've never read any of her work.
I think you stay on topic more than Anne Rice does, in fairness.
I do? Really?
Yeah, I find she's a bit sort of.
Well, she rambles?
Yeah. It's not bad, it's just she's very caught up in her own prose, I think.
Oh, okay. You know, I was, when the very first draft was very flowery and purple. I wanted to emphasize they were beautiful, 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 you know? But I cut all that out before I submitted it to my current publisher. No, and I just wanted to, no, I wanted, what I wanted to do mainly was just express that they are gorgeous creatures who do terrible things.
Yeah.
Mainly. My vampires. And then the lichens.
Evil little love.
I don't like werewolves. They're not my favorite monster. Oh, I'm not, I can't say that. Watching Underworld, the prequel one,
yeah,
with, you know, the backstory, that was when I was like, oh, lichens are pretty cool. But no, I don't. You're gonna see as it goes along. I kind of just like push my lichens to the side, kind of. And all my, like, all the people who love werewolves are like, well, you should get more, you know. And I'm like, no, this is about the vampire, sorry.
So speaking of monsters and things like that, obviously, okay, you know, vampires is a big tick as far as you're concerned.
Yeah.
You know, you were influenced by Dracula when you first saw it. But what about some of our other classic monsters? Talk to me a little bit about that. Before we started the show, you mentioned that you just bought film for Frankenstein. Is that right?
Yes, I did. I actually read Frankenstein, like, last year? For the first time.
Oh, right. What did you think?
I was surprised because, you know, it wasn't, everyone, you know, makes it out to be this, like, story, and it's, you don't realize it's entirely in letters. Is it in letters? Or he's telling the story to someone else.
Yeah.
throughout the story. Yeah, and it's very different from what I thought. Oh, and I actually use in book three, because that's when I was reading it for school, and I was trying to meet the deadline also, so I obviously was influenced by it. Something happens. I can't tell you what. But there's a very Frankenstein-esque feel, like when Victor was running, not in my book, in Frankenstein, when he was like, you know, running, trying to go back home or something, and he was like running through like woods and the monster was everywhere type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I have that theme kind of going where this, you know, monster, I guess, is just around and it just appears out of nowhere at times and just does things, which I'm not gonna spoil. But the book Frankenstein itself was really different from what I thought it was going to be. It was interesting. Did I like it? I don't know if I liked it.
No, that's fair enough.
I was really surprised that the monster could learn to speak so well.
That's the bit that always gets me, and the fact that he learns to read by reading Shakespeare and Chaucer. And
yes, so well, so fast. And he's like, I want, you know, a partner. Like, whoa, dude, you were just born. Like,
wait your turn.
Take
man.
A break.
Exactly. Oh, and speaking of Frankenstein, I finished watching Penny Dreadful recently.
Oh my gosh.
What is that?
I haven't watched the latest season, but I always feel really sorry for Frankenstein and in the series, because I'm just there like he's such a little man child and he needs to be protected from literally everything, including himself.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and what surprised me also in the book was how he ran away when the monster opened its eyes. And I was like, dude, what are you doing? And he just couldn't face, you know, he couldn't face what he did, he made. And he was so obsessed with it forever. And then when it finally happened, he didn't know how to take. I don't think he realized it would actually happen.
No, I said, how could he? Is there a great post, which was this, someone said, how could Frankenstein be building this thing and only notice that it was ugly when it, you know, it was completed? Oh. And I'm like, clearly you've never worked on a piece of artwork for hours and hours and hours and you finish it.
Oh, wow, that's a good point.
Like, oh my god, it's awful.
Oh, shh.
Which version of the film was it you got? Was it the one with Kenneth Branagh in it? Or is it a later?
Yes. It has Robert De Niro and Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, and it's the bit where it's Frankenstein's mentor is saying, do you think this thing will thank you for its monstrous birth? Bits of murderers, bits of thieves, evil stitched to evil stitched. And it's like that bit always sticks in my head. And it's kind of like, that's probably the sort of thing as a parent, not in the same way, but you should be asking yourself a case of, are you ready, you know, for the responsibilities of parenthood?
Exactly. Like, are you sure you want what you made?
Yeah. I was going to say, I saw the play, and what they did there was that they said Frankenstein, you know, was obsessed with creating life, and he had the woman he was in love with, her name, and she was just there like, we can make life, we can literally, like,
yeah.
You do
get
right
married
now.
To me, we can totally make life, this is a thing that people do regularly, Victor, what are you doing?
I want to do it solo.
Yeah, it's just... It was very reminiscent of, I want to be a woman, I want to have a child. You haven't got a womb. Oh, keep it in a pot.
Well, that makes me remember, like, my series, how, but just what happens and, like, how the world is created, kind of.
Yeah.
And how it goes from the world to the dark world, basically, with, I don't know how to say it, with the appearance of, you know, vampires and werewolves, and you know how they're born, as it were, and how they take over, and you have their creator is kind of like, what did we do? And they're just like, oh god, we made monsters, basically. And I play on the word abominations in, as the series goes on as well, like they get called abominations, and even the vampires are like calling themselves abominations because things come to light and they realize they're not all they seem, basically. Yeah. All Eleanor can see is power, so she doesn't care.
Nice.
Yeah.
It is. I just want to say something really effusive and then I'll stop butting in. It is one of the best dark fantasy worlds I've read for probably a decade at least.
Oh, stop.
No, honestly, I loved the world building. It was just amazing.
There was world building?
Yeah, there was world building. It might have happened without you realising it, but it was definitely there. It felt like you'd got under the skin kind of thing as a reader.
That's a real compliment coming from Jill, since she's read like every book in existence.
I know I have.
You're right, but she's getting there, you know.
I might do before I die, you never know.
That's so nice. Oh my goodness. Because when I was writing it, it was just, I just focused on the characters. And, you know, obviously, like, you can't have vampires and werewolves messing up everything. Like, who's going to clean it up? So you have the cleaners, who are enchanters and elves, who clean up everything. That's basically what my witches do throughout the series. And I didn't even realize that that was, like, world. It was just, okay, so these characters do this. So what are the repercussions for that? And I don't know. I write the story like as it's happening in my head, so the characters' reactions are real and to you, so what's happening at the time. Yeah. If that makes sense. Yeah. So I don't know. I just didn't realize it was like world building.
Going back to Frankenstein and mm-hmm. Dracula. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you managed to bring that sort of essence of even if of only an essence of sort of Frankenstein and the creature sort of chasing it. The thing I like about Frankenstein and Dracula is that they often get sort of put together because they're two of the big famous classics.
Yeah.
But they are actually kind of contrary in the message that is behind them.
Yeah.
And in Dracula, basically, I've always read it as the past and the future against each other. So Dracula is this very old creature, and how do they combat him? They use new scientific things, you know, blood transfusions, you know, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. That's how they combat. They're using science and innovation, and I don't think it's, you know, you look at the author Bram Stoker, he was Irish and he came from a very different background. Then when you look at Frankenstein, Mary Shelley was mm-hmm. British, not making that up, she was British, and instead it reflects this fear of innovation, of God, where are we going to stop, what can we do with the future? So it's actually about saying no, leave, some things are better left alone.
I mean, it was the time. I think it's quite interesting to look at where Mary Shelley was coming from at the time. She was technically Mary Godwin at the time. She was with Percy Bysshe Shelley, but they hadn't got married because Percy Bysshe Shelley was already married to someone else.
Yes, very awkward.
No chance of divorce. So basically, he had to wait for his wife to die. And they'd had a child together when Mary Shelley was only 17. She was only 19 when she wrote Frankenstein. And the child had died. So Mary Shelley was coming from a position of, you know, being a mother who'd lost a child very, very recently.
Oh, yeah.
So to talk about something where life was being created in a preternatural or scientifically unnatural way, this was as part of the discussions they had in the evenings with Byron and John Polidori. And Polidori was obviously a physician at the time, and it was around the time that medicine was taking a leap forward. So
mm-hmm.
even though we don't know exactly what was said, you can kind of infer from what she's written who was taking what position in the argument, and I find that really fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And I think it's also, you know, we consider the era that it was written in, and you know, the Industrial Revolution, where the English and the British began to basically romanticize the past in a way, and kind of almost reject industry in some ways because they were frightened of losing their identity.
Yeah.
Whereas that wasn't so much a thing that was happening in Ireland. And so when you compare Frankenstein and Dracula, it's about saying, look at the good that industry is doing, and then look at the bad that industry is doing.
Well, yeah, you'd have just been coming from the potato famine in Ireland.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So an industry where they were coming over here and starting to work in the factories because our workers were going on strike. I mean, there's a whole thing going on there that was really bad and people were being really badly paid and really badly treated.
Yeah.
But it must have looked really promising to the Irish who came over, who literally could not make enough food to feed themselves. Because it was all being shipped out of Ireland into England. So it probably did look like industry the way forward.
Yeah, basically. And also, you know, modern medicines, life actually getting easier, making life easier for families and for poorer families and things like that. Because, of course, the whole crisis was more about the wealthy going, oh, but what about our gardens?
Yes, pretty much.
So yeah, it's interesting to compare them because they are in essence the opposite, where Frankenstein is the new creature, the creature of the future, whereas Dracula is the creature of the past, and yet they are so easily put together in a lot of stories and in a lot of, you know, modern adaptations.
Yeah, they are. It's all the Hammer horrors I'm thinking of, and you two probably haven't watched them. I grew up watching Hammer horrors with my dad, and they are so cheesy, but there is something really, really enduring about them as well. And it is Dracula sort of all done up in a dinner jacket and a cape with gelled hair. And Frankenstein has bolts in his neck because we don't know how to display something that's been stitched together and genetically engineered, basically. Mm-hmm.
But I love the... Again, this is something, a post I saw where someone had taken the last page of Frankenstein and they just amended it and added a few lines as Frankenstein's monster is running off. He just shouts, by the way, you can just call me Frankenstein. You don't need to call me Frankenstein's monster. I don't mind.
I did see that post. That was funny.
I think I saw it because you reblogged it. I think that's where I saw it. But I did like that. I really did laugh.
That was great, yeah.
Okay, I want to bring up another classic that was roughly contemporary between those two, which is Robert Louis Stevenson's The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
I haven't read that one. But I know, you know, I know of it so much.
There must be so much in the zeitgeist. I'm sure you both sort of roughly know what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, weirdly, it does seem to sort of marry the two ideas, like the future and the past. And it is very much set in the present, but you have science almost meeting mysticism in it. And it's very much a case of, well, I understand that there is a shadow self, an id, if you like, and I need to find a way to tap into it. So you have... Dr. Jekyll, who is actually the good guy, you wouldn't believe it from the name, tapping into it by creating this serum that allows him to really... I mean, I think a lot of the films show him physically changing and becoming more bestial, but actually that's not what happens in the book. He literally changes persona and that's it. So he just...
It's also about the way that he, you know, he holds himself and the way he moves.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, I think it was just made easier in the early cinema type films for it, that they made him look a little bit different as well.
Yeah.
But I think it's really interesting because that one particularly, all of these books in fairness do, but that one particularly really looks at man being the monster.
Yeah.
And it's the conflict between these two sides of his personality that drives that entire plot. I mean, it's quite a short book.
Oh my God. Yeah, because that it is. I mean, you compare it, Dracula is man versus monster. Frankenstein is man creates monster, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is man is monster.
Yeah.
No, my God. I'm sorry. No, that's, I don't want to like shamelessly plug again, but that is basically the essence of my series. Like, I deal with anxiety and depression a lot. So all of my characters do, basically. It's what drives them. Anxiety is what drives them forward, and their angst and whatever else. And with that, you said that, and I'm sorry, like the man is the monster type of thing.
Yeah.
For mine, it's, you know, Xavier, personally, is, like, the monster, but not in the sense of, like, being this vampire, but, you know, fighting himself and fighting what he really wants versus what everyone else is telling him what to do.
Yeah,
and
like his demons.
Yeah, and he basically grows as the series goes on, but not in a good sense, in a really bad sense, in a sense where he's following what he really wants to do, but it's to the detriment of everyone else, because he's so wrapped up in Eleanor's dread and the anxiety she induces in the world. What's inside of him himself is just coming out, but it's warped, because I don't know if you guys deal with anxiety as well, but anxiety just doesn't, it messes up your mind, so you're not thinking clearly, and you're always in a fight or flight mode where you just don't, you're just wound up too much, and that just makes it really hard to think and relax and just, you know, see things clearly. So none of my characters are ever seeing anything clearly, but especially Xavier, he's just super messed up in the head, and he can't separate, you know, who he really is against the dread that he's feeling all the time. Like, it never leaves him, basically.
Yeah.
So sorry, I just wanted to say that.
That was an incredibly good point. And it makes me think a little bit about horrors that
actually work on the worries and the stresses of the mind.
Yeah.
And I've recently finished The Turn of the Screw, because I'm actually teaching it in my class, or I was teaching it. And one of the things, you know, that you make out there is that you only have, you have one author, you have one narrator, rather. You don't know how reliable she is as a narrator. Mm-hmm. You also know for a fact that this is a story that has been told to someone else, written down, and then retold again from the beginning. Yeah. So immediately you know that there is, it's not necessarily reliable. And no one else ever sees anything. It's only ever this character and her word for it. And, you know, we were talking about the isolation and the stress of what she's going through, because she starts off very happy. And then by the end, a lot of the things she's dealing with her own fear. She gets very anxious. She gets very flighty. Several times she thinks about leaving, and then she decides not to leave. During a time when they were, you know, hysteria is also something you see a lot of in the Gothic.
Yes. Hysteria.
And I think hysteria and anxiety go hand in hand, if we're honest. So, it's an interesting, definitely an interesting point, and definitely not one that should be ignored. That the demons, the scariest demons, often are the ones of our own creation, the ones in our mind.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I actually show my female, the only human in the book in the series so far, Alexandria Stone. She, in the second book, I mean, she's, by then in the second book, she's been, you know, chased by Lycans, and she's, like, carried around by Christian, basically, who is this, like, I don't care about humans, you know, vampire. He's very, like, you know, old school. Very, like, I will drink your blood, I don't care about you type of vampire. And at one point, she just blows up on him, and she just freaks out, because, you know, it's not from her point of view, like, the whole, like, everything's basically about the vampires, but she just can't take it anymore, and she's just like, I can't understand any of this, and I don't know why, you know, I'm here, and all these beasts and monsters are chasing me, and they want me for my blood, and she just can't deal with it, so she has a full-blown anxiety attack, basically.
Understandable.
Kind of interested to see how Christian deals with that, because I don't think he's equipped to be honest.
No, actually, he's not. He deals with it like he deals with any other human, but he realizes he can't with her because she is different in a way. So, I love them, actually. I love Christian and Alexandria together. But, and it took me a really long time to figure out how to write a human dealing with anxiety, believe it or not. Dealing with hysteria, and it took me I didn't know how to write her for the longest. I didn't know who she was or, like, what, you know, what she would be feeling, and I just had no idea, because I just kept, you know, I just kept writing about vampires and werewolves, and that was fun, but writing about her, she was always crying or screaming or shaking, you know, or scared. She was never, like, ever calm.
I feel like maybe you just quietly confessed to us that you're not a human being.
I feel that way sometimes. No, I never, you know what the big thing was too? When I started writing it, Twilight blew up. So I very much did not want to, I felt like restricted in a sense because Bella, you know, is, you know.
Bella.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. She's her. And I know everyone was asking me because I was writing it. They're like, it's like Twilight. And I'm like, no, it's not. And I didn't want to make Alexandria a Bella, basically. Yeah. And I didn't know how to do that, you know, because she is human and she's gonna deal with it differently than she's put myself in her shoes, basically. And I was like, how would I deal with a vampire in front of me? I would freak the fuck out. I would be so scared. No, my vampires are not attractive to me. They're not like something I want to bone. They are something. No. They are something you run away from. To me, they're terrifying.
I'm with you on that.
People ask me all the time if, you know, Christian was, like, down the street from me. I would try my best to run away, but he would kill me. You know? Like, he would reach up to me and kill me. Like, there is no, like, I'm just a bag of, like, blood to him. Like, I, you know? It's not, like, there's no romanticism, you know, with me and my vampires. They're just, they're monsters. Like, take them out of, put them in this world, they would have a free-for-all.
Well, it would be like a human and a shark, really, wouldn't it?
So yes.
It's like that's not a natural pairing.
Basically. And I put a scene in the second book where Alexandria, you know, she's alone and she's scared and she's very, very hungry. And she's like, she has this internal dialogue where she's like, I'm so starving. And she's like, but she's like, I'm so scared. And she's freaking out. And she runs into a vampire shop. And, you know, Christian and them have been really nice to her because they have to be. But outside of that, she realizes that, you know, vampires aren't, you know, they're the exception. And I just want to put that into, like, kind of show that even though Christian and company are, you know, protecting her and keeping her safe, that's not the natural disposition of the vampires to do that.
No. I completely get what you're talking about. It takes me back of people. For me, it's not sharks. It's killer whales, orcas.
Yeah.
Yes.
And everyone's like, oh, yeah, orcas, they're so cute. They're so playful.
Oh, they're not cute. It's a seal.
I went to the National History Museum. They've just got this giant orca skeleton hanging above, from the ceiling. And you look at it and I just grabbed my brother and I pointed at it and I said, that is not the skeletal structure of a thing that wants to be your friend. Look at that. It looks like a dinosaur. Those teeth. Like, I think orcas are amazing. I think they're great. I would not want to meet one.
No, never. I don't like the water, period. So anything in the water, I can't deal with.
I'm like, yeah, that's... Everyone's like, oh, there's an orca. I'm like, that's fantastic. Let's not go near it.
Exactly.
Let's just leave it to do its thing. Because it's awesome and it's pretty and, you know, it's all those things. But you know what?
Yes.
It does not want to be my friend and I hope you want to be its friend. So
exactly.
We're good.
Okay, I'm going to steer you away from orcas for just a moment.
Oh.
And steer you back towards female vampires, because female vampires were written about in literature way before Dracula, way
yes.
before Frankenstein, and way before The Vampire by John Polidori. So I'm thinking of Christabel by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, although you could argue that maybe she isn't a vampire, and Carmilla by Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu.
Yeah.
Either of those ringing a bell for anybody?
Yep.
Just
yes,
me.
No, I know of Carmella, but I haven't read it yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a brief synopsis then. Christabel is the incomplete poem that was written, I think it was 1787 or something like that. And it was the one that Byron was actually reading out when they were all stuck in Via Diodati. And he got to the bit where he was describing the demon woman below the shoulders, where she actually becomes quite demonic. And Percy Bysshe Shelley had a fit of the vapours and started screaming and ran out into the rain.
A fit of the excuse me?
I don't know what else you want to call it.
Jesus, and they say women are hysterical.
I think it's really funny. Now, either that was Percy Bysshe Shelley going, oh, for God's sake, Byron, shut up. I tell you, I'm going to fake having a panic attack. Or it was a genuine, I've had a bit too much laudanum this evening.
Yes, probably, most likely.
Or it might have been both, a mixture of both. That how can I get Byron to shut up? Also, I feel like I'm crawling across the ceiling.
And in Christabel, you have two women. You have the innocent, Christabel is the innocent, and then you have her taking in a poor woman who says she's been attacked by some rough men. That's as descriptive as it gets on that. And then she turns out to be a sort of demon woman below the neck. And I don't know, there are various people who've read it as sort of the fact that they're sharing a bed, which really, to be honest, wasn't very unusual for women at the time if they were unmarried. People have read it as a sort of, you know, budding lesbian type thing. And
That was the first thing I was going to shout the moment you said it. I was going to shout the word lesbians very loudly.
And if you compare it to Carmilla, there is an element of that again, because you have, it's Laura in Carmilla, Laura, and they take in Carmilla, who turns out to be one of Laura's ancestresses. From several hundred years before, and Laura starts weakening, and all the girls in the village start weakening. And it's very interesting that these female vampiric creatures prey almost exclusively on young virginal females, I find. So
yeah.
Again, you could perhaps read it as a sort of burgeoning awakening of sexuality and things like that.
And personally,
yes.
I think that actually that's the reason why they have not been made as popular as Dracula.
Yeah, probably.
Because actually, I think it wasn't just that. I mean, Dracula. It was fine for Dracula to attack women because Dracula was a man. And for the moment you have a a female antagonist, and this goes back to why aren't there a lot of female antagonists, and I honestly think it was because, until very recently, the publishing world was dominated by an exclusive set of rich, old, middle-class white men.
Yes.
Who were threatened by the prospect of women being more powerful. And mm-hmm. so we got very little representation of females in powerful positions. And if they are in powerful positions, they're very often shadowed. They're very often not the main character. So sometimes, you know, we have a Queen Victoria-esque sort of character.
Yeah.
But they're very prudish, I guess, in some ways, whenever mm-hmm. you do have that kind of character. So to have a sexualized woman who is in charge of her own fate, who is, and when we think of Dracula himself, I mean, Dracula, there is a sexual element to Dracula in the way they do it, the exchanging of fluids, etc., etc., etc.
Yes.
So it's the same. Vampires have got, you know, have a huge origin and a relationship with succubi and incubi. So having these female vampires who, yes, they attack other women, and I think actually that's the only reason they kind of got away with it, because I think if you had a female vampire who was attacking other men,
mm-hmm.
it wouldn't
work.
They would have gone to no, we can't possibly have this. They're like, okay, so we have an evil woman, and yeah, I guess so, she's attacking other women, but I guess this isn't really a woman, it's just a demon pretending to be, you know,
they don't want to call her a woman.
Yeah, but if it turned around that it was a demon woman attacking men, that they wouldn't be able to deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that doesn't really ever get I mean, if you think about it with the two examples I mentioned, Christabel and Carmilla, mm-hmm. you've got these two old white dudes who are writing what is basically titillating semi-porn left to the imagination for other old white dudes. It's not written for young women to read because it's distasteful. And it doesn't really get corrected until Edgar Allan Poe starts writing about Lenore.
Ah, Mr. Poe.
I love him.
Don't surprise me.
No, it doesn't surprise me.
No, I have a collection of all of his work, and I'm still like shifting my way through it, but he's a big influence on me.
Yeah, he quite often makes the female character is quite often the predator, and she quite often succeeds as well.
Yes.
Not necessarily giving a very positive depiction of women in general.
No.
And he'd had rather a checkered love life, but...
It is interesting, because I read The Telltale Heart again recently. It's another one we were studying. And The Telltale Heart, the character at the end, basically has a fit of hysteria. Now, you don't often get, again in the Gothic, you don't often get men falling into hysteria. It was more than not, it was the female characters who had hysteria. So Edgar Allan Poe, not only did he have all these female characters who were devious and got away with it, mm-hmm. he had male characters who did bad things, who then fell prey to hysteria and couldn't contain their own guilt.
Yes, yes, he did.
Which was quite nice.
I think that's where I got my idea from. Honestly, no, because every single one of my characters is dealing with some sort of hysteria. They have some type of breakdown once, or you know,
they're under a lot of stress, so that doesn't really surprise
me. They are. And I want to go back to what we talked about, where female vampires, you know, and the lesbian thing. Mm-hmm. This is kind of spoilery, but not really. I don't care if you guys get mad at me, because I just want to say this. No, you know how you said Dracula is very sensual and everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In my series, he's not. He doesn't know what love is. He's never felt it before. He can't access that. My vampires in general can access real emotion. They can access like, you know, wisps of it, not the actual essence of it. But he just doesn't bother with it. But Victor, his first turned, is in love with him. Like, legit, like he's gay. Like, he loves Dracula. And that is kind of his downfall as the series goes on. But, Dracula in my series just does not. He is, I guess you can say, he is the, how do I say this? He, in religious terms, I would, for like Christians, I would say he's like the Jesus figure, kind of.
Yeah.
And he just leaves his followers, as you would, to clean up the mess he started.
Yeah.
Basically.
Nice.
He's like the martyr. There's no like emotional depth to him. It's strictly I need to accomplish my goal.
Yeah, he's not a great seducer. It is noticeable that you haven't gone down that route with him, which is interesting because most people are like, oh, that's one thing we've got to have in about Dracula.
The people he's left behind and like how they deal with it. They're more human than he is.
I feel like Dracula sort of, if we think of Dracula from, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula as a slightly a younger version, you know, he puts a lot of effort into being the seducer. So maybe by the time he just gets to you, he's just there, to be honest, I can't be bothered. I don't have to deal with this anymore. See, before he had to do it in order to get fed and stuff like that. And now he's just got all these lackeys.
Well, yeah, he's made this whole world of, you know, there's vampires in America in my story. There's vampires like all over the world. And so they each have.
Why would he need to be have that human element? Why would he need to have any of that now?
It goes back to the guilt. No, he doesn't really ever take blood. My Dracula, you never... Xavier also, you never really see... Xavier never really takes blood. I say that he does, but you never see it happen, unlike Christian. And I wanted to make that point that...
Christian takes blood in the first, like, few pages.
Yes. Yes. But Xavier does not ever really drink. You will never see him really drink human blood. I'll never put that in a scene. Christian does. Dracula, you'll never see him drink human blood. And he doesn't. Dracula has a very... He does not want to be what he is at all. And as the series goes on, you'll know why. I don't know if I don't know if this is spoiling anything or not.
Go on.
Okay, for it.
Are you sure?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, so Dracula's true form, basically, is the winged, monstrous, vampiric beast type of thing.
Yeah.
And he got his humanesque form through an enchanter who he coerced to, you know, give him, to be more human, basically, so he could accomplish his goals to become human permanently. And he just does not want to be, you know, he doesn't want to ever return to that monstrous form. And as the series goes on, you see he has trouble holding on to that humanesque form. Because the monstrous form shines through at times. As the series goes on, the Xavier and company realize, you know, what they really are, like what their true form is, and it freaks. They can't deal with it because, you know, Dracula never told them, you know. So they're just like, whoa, like everything that we knew is like a lie, basically. And then they see why all the other creatures are so terrified of vampires, or so, you know, they bend to their will so easily, and it's not just because they're like seducers and they, you know, people listen to them easily. It's because they have this other essence, basically, and that's what Eleanor wants to get a hold of again, basically, because she believes that is the that's their true power. No, but it's a fun read, so hopefully you'll still read it.
Okay, yeah. This is something that I read recently, and I do kind of agree with it to a certain extent, although I think it's a bit more complicated, so I'll be interested to see what you guys think. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who was a psychiatrist who wrote rather a lot about grieving, among other things, said there's only two emotions, fear and love, and all the negative emotions come from a place of fear, and all the positive emotions come from a place of love.
Yes.
And horror and dark fantasy teach us about fear. She didn't say that bit. That's my postulation, that horror teaches us about fear, which is why it's actually important.
I tend to agree with that, but then I also point out that when you get horror, and in particular when you get the gothic, this is the difference between horror and the gothic, is every time you get the gothic, there is always an element of love in it as well, but it's very often a kind of twisted love.
Yeah.
So in the case of Xavier, that is a twisted love, it's a twisted obsession.
Yes.
And then, you know, it's the same, we get Heathcliff, and Kathy, obsessive love.
Mm-hmm.
Frankenstein's obsessive kind of love for his mother was kind of what prompted him to create this creature.
Shit, basically. In the first place. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and so it's all about the unnatural kind of relationships that occur. And so it's almost a basically saying, actually, we should be wary of love. And what it can do to us, and the power of love, and how it is actually is dangerous. So it's about saying, yeah, so there are two emotions. We have fear and love, but actually you should be afraid of love.
Well, it sounds to me it's sort of saying that love creates fear.
It does. Ah. Absolutely it does. Because once you feel so strongly for someone else, there's that fear of, oh no, what if they die and I'm without them? Or, You know, just any kind of fear. What if they get into an accident one day? Yeah, it's
what if they leave? What if they betray me? What if it's not real?
And that's what I've had to deal with in my relationships personally, like getting over that fear, because I worry about everything that there is to worry about in the world, and I've recently been like teaching myself not to do that and to just, you know, and that kind of fear comes with attachment, like you're holding, you know, you believe that this person belongs to you when they don't. And no matter how deep into relationship you're in with them or with, you know, with the person, you can't ever think that, you know, this person is yours, you know, putting that label of mine or, you know, having some kind of like they're your property or they belong to you. Because no one belongs to anyone. And that's where the fear starts to come in. If you think, oh no, like they're talking to someone else, they're cheating on me, I've lost this part of myself or this thing, basically. And that's wrong love. That's obsessive.
So we could, in theory, argue that horror and dark fantasy, which teach us about love as well as fear, if the more we understand both of those things, the better adjusted we are possibly as people. The more we can aim for being better adjusted.
Yes. And I realize I've been using my series as, you know, a catharsis where I'm learning about my anxiety and my tendencies and how I am in relationships. And the more that I learn about myself and how not to do those things, the more that Alexandria and Christian's relationship gets healthier. I mean, they're not together yet in book 5, but they're
going to get together. Yes.
They're heading there. Yeah, the more that I, because to me, I always wanted their relationship to mirror Eleanor and Xavier's relationship. And just what to do and what not to do in a relationship, basically. Yeah.
But then it goes to show that there is a relationship between fear and love.
Exactly.
And where there is horror, there is usually a form of love, and it's usually a doomed form of love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think it's as you say, love creates fear. The moment we become attached to things is the moment that you know, people are truly afraid, and that goes in the day to day as well, even in healthy relationships, and not just, mm-hmm. you know, falling in love, but I mean, the moment you have a child, for instance, you're going to mm-hmm. spend all your time worrying about that child the moment,
yes,
when they're out of, you know, sight. And, you know, it's things like, I'll call my, you know, my dad when I've sort of been driving to the airport, and I'll say, yeah, no, I've arrived safely. And it doesn't occur to me how important that is to him. But then on the reverse side, every time he goes for a trip, or anytime I'm with anyone and they're going home, I always say, can you message me when you're home safe? Because that's just what it is to be human. The more attachments you have, the more things you have to be worried about.
Exactly.
The more you have to lose.
Okay, another thing. I totally forgot about the lichens. Lore is the head, the king, the Lycan king in my book. And he has a son. I don't know, I don't want to tell you how he had that son, but yeah, it's not fun. He had a son, and his son is living with the humans, basically, as a duke. And his son has a wife. Him and his father are always fighting over, you know, her, because Lore's like, you know, you don't need to love this human, basically. And they're always fighting over his son's love and his humanity that his son is trying to hold on to and, you know, be as the humans and whatnot. So, yeah, just yet another man. All of my men are just a mess. They're terrible. I'm sorry. I guess it's an exact answer to the Bella character in Twilight. Whatever. We're not going to talk about Twilight because I'll just get mad.
It's not really horror either. So.
No, it's not. She shouldn't have called them vampires. She should have called them fairies or something. Something else.
Excuse me.
Oh dear.
Actually, I'm inclined to agree with you, but we're not going to talk about the F word because you know me. When Oops. We get started,
I have fairies in mind though too.
We're not going to go the whole fair. Don't let's not okay. do that. Right, Oops. Jules.
Gods, I'm surrounded.
I'm sorry, Jules. I just finished reading your latest short stories, and what were the main antagonists in that? Oh, that's right, they were fairies.
Ew.
So don't get upsy with me, young lady.
Is this a bad topic, fairies, or
no, friendly no. antagonism?
Basically, my PhD is on fairies, so I actually talk about them far too much, and so Jules threatened to make me start not a swear jar, but a fairy jar. So every time I say fairy.
Noted.
I've got to resist the urge to start talking about fairies, because otherwise we'll be here all day. Anyway, no, Jules, what were you saying?
Gothic fiction. Yes, a lot of the older ones sort of fall down a bit for me because, and I think it's the time they were written in as much as anything else, because they're lacking a little bit in emotional content. And I think that's because a lot of them are written sort of as cautionary tales as well as sort of as titillation.
Can we talk about sirens or mermaids or the myth of maidens pulling sailors to their death or what have you?
Yeah, definitely.
I think that's really creepy. And as such, no, my mermaids, when it came to write them, it was how do I want them to look, first and foremost. And you see one at the end of book one, but I didn't really get into depth on how it looked. But in book two, they come across them, and they are really freaking scary. I don't like the water, so anything that can pull you into the water if you try to, you know, swim or, you know, just wade in their water freaks me out, and I can't deal with it. So that's how I made my merpeople fly over their water unless you have their permission, and you can't swim in their water or else they will drown you and pull you down. And they also have like horrible teeth and like fanged teeth. Everyone has fangs in my freaking series, but they have horrible fanged teeth and like webs, and their skin is like translucent and gray and just disgusting, and they're just ugh, like completely black eyes, and they're not beautiful at all. Like, they're just very...
It's interesting. Let's very quickly talk about just talk about your description there.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very interesting, which is that we mentioned, of course, the beauty of some creatures, some creatures in the Gothic. And very often, monsters are humanoid.
Yes.
But they're either very beautiful or they're very ugly. And one of the main things that happens is when they're ugly, they have features which are considered unnatural on humans or associated with certain things. So grey skin is one of them. Yes. And, you know, we look at the creature in Frankenstein, and I think he had grey, yellowish skin, is that
right?
Yeah, I think he did as well. Mm-hmm. And he had yellow eyes, I think.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. I think when, you know, talking about yellow eyes, I'm not sure they actually meant the iris was yellow. I think it meant that, like, it was a kind of a jaundiced sort of yellow.
Yeah.
So it was this association with this dishealth, these things that look ill, that mm-hmm. look decaying, and that is that association with fear. So when you're describing your mermaids and your sirens, you know, you basically decided that the thing you wanted them to be ugly, you wanted them to be scary because of your fear. But it's interesting again that even now to this day, our idea of what should look wrong and what should sort of set alarm bells off in our heads continues to be very similar to what it was 100 years ago.
I don't think it's ever going to change.
And I think it all comes down to our fear of death, to be honest.
Well, it's absolutely. The corpse, isn't it? Well, also, they're also looked that way because, well, when they meet them, it's night, but they're mostly at the bottom of the ocean, so they're not going to have access to sunlight, pretty much. And they're not going to be healthy looking because of that, in a sense. So that also plays into it, too.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is that, I completely get that, but it uh-huh. makes total logical sense. But then at the same time, you could have said that they were, you know, green. So it's not like, you know, fish are pale.
Yeah.
As well, you know. So it is interesting that was the decision you make. And I think our fear of death and our fear of the unknown in that respect and things which are dying, the taboo with things that are dying and dead bodies has mm-hmm. continued to exist in horror and is one of the unchanging factors, something that even as we develop, and I've always thought of horror and the monsters in our, and in particular fairies, because I might as well say the word now, no one else has said it, have always been personifications of mm-hmm. what we are most afraid of. So depending Absolutely. What era it is, that they personify differently. And yet, even though monsters change forms and monsters, what those monsters represent changes. Mm-hmm. This one aspect does not change. The inhuman, the association with corpses, the association with death continues mm-hmm. on. And I think it will always continue on until we stop dying, basically.
Yes. I actually did a thesis on horror movies in high school, on like why we watch them when they cause us fear. Mm-hmm. And like Godzilla, for instance, that was Japan's answer to the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
Basically. And just, I just went way back, like, to Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and, like, all of those, you know, old horror movies and what scared people back then wouldn't necessarily scare people now because they were pretty, like, for the time, they terrified.
Yeah. But,
and now we have, like, all these effects and everything and we can, like, you know, make, like, really scary looking things or what have you.
Yeah, but I think in some ways with all the effects we've kind of forgotten what actually we've kind of forgotten the essence of fear, which is that the reason these things in the past were scary was mm-hmm. because of the associations they had with certain things. And I think now everyone's they're like, oh well, this used to scare us, so we're just gonna smack on a good special effect for it and that'll be enough. And people totally forget that actually it's not enough to just smack on a special effect. You also have to look at why it was scary in the past and whether it's still going to be scary now. It's like the witches of Macbeth. They're not scary in the same way now that they were in the past. They just aren't.
And part of that is, with horror and dark fantasy, you can't just have a series of worsening events. The worsening mm-hmm. events have to be the casing, if you like, of the actual story. And the story has to be what the worsening events are making the characters into, what it's making them do. That's the scary part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because otherwise it just becomes a Dragon Ball Z kind
of. It becomes like every other boring slasher film. I don't know about anyone else, but the gory ones are just like... I'm usually just sat there going, A, that's not very realistic, I've seen worse than that, and B, this is just boring me now.
See, a lot of people really didn't enjoy the second season of The Walking Dead, and to me it was my favourite season, because I really freaked me out, because you've just got all these characters, and actually, you know, the walkers kind of became a bit sort of oblivious. You know, they were in the background all the time, they were the background threat, but the scary thing, the way that the characters were changing and these the way that they were trying to survive and who they were becoming in the process and the loss of their humanity, basically.
Yes. Zombies and me don't mix. I do not like zombies.
No, neither do I, to be honest.
They terrify me. I need like Z Nation, I don't know if you guys watch it. Z Nation is, I prefer it over The Walking Dead because I can't. I watched like 3 seasons of The Walking Dead and I just, it was too much. It was a lot of like self-reflection and it's about humanity and everything, and that's cool, you know, if it's a movie, but like every single week, like I was just like, okay, I'm tired of the, you know, the philosophizing about like life and what it means to be alive and when there's like a zombie like shambling and zombies itself, like just the idea of people coming back to life in that sense, like where it's desiccated and just your arms are falling. I can't deal with it. Like, oh my god, I can't. It's just, no.
See, the thing I hate about zombies, and I'm really, you know, first of all, they've been overdone. Second of all,
thank you. Yes, they have.
Second, I really don't like zombies. They freak me out.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that I watched a series called iZombie, which I kind of enjoyed. I didn't ever finish
it.
But the thing that really freaked me out about zombies was the lack of... I'm always frightened, and again, this just shows what, you know, my fear, so why I'm frightened of monsters in this way. Frightened of monsters with which you cannot negotiate. Like, there's something more scary about the idea of being strapped to a table and someone saying, right, I'm going to torture you, I'm going to make you scream. And it's scarier, actually, if someone straps you to the table and you're begging with them and they don't even consider it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's more frightening. And then again with zombies, right, I'm terrified of zombies because I think if a zombie attacks me, you cannot... you literally lose all control of the kind of the situation. You can't talk to them. You can't reason with them. There's nothing you can do. And you can't just say it's crazy or anything like that. The other thing is that, you know, if it's people say, oh, well, you know, it's just as scary as being attacked by a pack of lions. I'm like, it isn't. Because a pack of lions, right, will go for your throat, okay? They'll attack you, they'll kill you, and then they'll eat you, okay? Because they don't want you thrashing around. They want you dead so that they can eat you, okay? Like, zombies don't have that kind of hunter instinct. So they just munch at you slowly. And that's... I'm not for that. Also, you know, lions need to sleep and zombies just shamble along.
Oh, yes. That's what I don't like. They're like constantly moving and that freaks me out. I can't deal with that.
Yeah, and that's a very terrifying part is that, you know, eventually you're going to get tired, but they will not. So you can try and outrun them forever, but eventually they will get tired. And yeah, that scares me. It scares me that you can have something which is relentless and just not even that they can't be, you know, reasoned with. It's not even that they're unreasonable. It's that it goes a level beyond that. Mm-hmm. You are literally nothing to them. You are totally insignificant. They cannot see you as, they do not see you as a living creature. You are inconsequential. You are food. And that's terrifying.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you off there. Because no, it's really interesting and I could keep going, but I'm just thinking we've overshot slightly.
Oh, goodness, sorry.
That's okay. So, wrapping up, looking back at Gothic literature.
We've looked at Dracula, Frankenstein, and how they are both the fear of progression and the uses of progression.
The strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which sits somewhere between the two. And also female vampires in Christabel and Carmilla.
We've also looked at hysteria and anxieties and demons of the mind in The Turn of the Screw. And obviously we've been discussing Sharon's books. Obviously.
All throughout.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Sharon seems to have managed to get all of the themes of all of these Gothic classics and a bit more into her work. So, you know,
big tick on that.
If you haven't read The Dark World, then you should definitely check it out.
You can find it. It's available on Amazon. It's also available through Barnes & Nobles and the Book Depository as well, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any links or a website that you'd like to share?
scparis.net. With two R's. It's going under renovations right now, but you can still access the books and everything.
That's great.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming onto the show.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
And to everyone listening to this, we here at Dissecting Dragons, we'd like to wish you a very happy Halloween.
Or a good Samhain.
Oh, yes. Both of those things. I'm a witch. I am a witch and I do celebrate Samhain, so.
There we go. Three witches cackling.
Yay!
This is us out.
Okay, so when shall we three meet again?
Hopefully very soon. Why don't we talk about witches in horror?
Yeah.
We'd have to bring James in as well.
Yeah.
We could have a four-person guest spot talking about witches, and he can talk about how nice they are, and I can talk about how awful they are.
That's a future date then.
And on that note, guys, we'll say goodbye. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.